Okay. In case you've wandered into the wrong class, we're chewing the tough bones, the dry bones of the Buddhist schools of tenets. And we are now talking about the Chittamatra view. Sometimes Chittamatra can be synonymous with Yogacara school. Sometimes Yogacara refers to a part, perhaps. But so we've gotten to the point where Chittamatra was one of their assertions is that there can be simultaneous cause and effect. It's not that all cause and effect is simultaneous, but there can be some instances, such as the consciousness that perceives, the sense consciousness that perceives an object, because the sense consciousness and the object both arise from the same seed or predisposition in the consciousness, and they both occur simultaneously. Right? I'll pretend it's, say, and Chittamatra says that's because the Buddha said, amongst other things, that you perceive a present object, whereas the upper tenets and some of the lower tenets, the upper tenets use the argument that what the Buddha meant when he said present object is there's no intervening moment between an object of one instant and the consciousness that arises from it the next instant. See? That's about where we were, right? Does that make sense? Okay, good. For the Chittamatrans, I'm reading again from Jeffrey Hopkins' book, Meditation on Emptiness, which we're using as sort of a basis for our discussion. And if you're looking in that book, this is from page 368. For the Chittamatrans, an object is the same nature or entity as its perceiving subject, we've mentioned many times, right? Illuminating and realizing objects. So Selshing Rigpa, this that which is clear or illuminating and knowing, is still the definition of consciousness. If an object were a mind, it would have to be shown that it apprehends objects, and such cannot be shown. I think we've mentioned that before. In this way, with object and subject the same entity and different conceptual isolates, you know, we were talking about this before. So two things can be the same entity, but still conceptually you can differentiate between them, such as an object, a conventional object, and its emptiness. They're said to be the same entity, but different isolates. Or they can be understood conceptually as different, even though they're the same entity. Generally, things that are the same entity arise to consciousness at the same time, such as the shape of this mug and its color and even its impermanence is said to appear as one entity with that which they are one entity with. Still, to eye consciousness, the eye consciousness, it's said that impermanence appears to the eye consciousness, but the eye consciousness does not perceive subtle impermanence, even though it's appearing. So it gives you a feeling there's some things that appear, but are not, you know, that even though the eye consciousness can see the shape and color, which are one entity with the mug, and the impermanence of the mug, excuse me, is the same entity, it's still the eye consciousness does not perceive that. It does not perceive the impermanence. Okay. There are no forms that are separate entities from the perceiving consciousnesses, Whereas according to the upper tenets, Prasangika, and according to Vaibhashika, there are external forms. There are forms that are different entities from the consciousness. But for Chittamatra, there are not. But there are forms that are the same entity of the perceiving consciousness. Again, as with the Prasangika assertion of nominally existing objects, nominally existent objects, the view is extremely subtle, and it should not be thought that because the system says there are objects, it is referring to objects as we think of them, as one knows them. For a sense consciousness of a sentient being perceives objects as if they were distant and cut off. That's another expression that comes in the texts about Chittamatra. It seems that the misconception is, for Chittamatra, that phenomena, sense objects, appear to be distant from the consciousness. Doesn't necessarily mean lineal distance, but they're not right within the consciousness, and they are cut off from the consciousness. They are not consciousness. They are not the same entity of the consciousness. That's how it appears to sentient beings. But for Chittamatra, that's an erroneous view, that because they really are the same entity as the consciousness, right? So saying the same thing several different ways, although the text is bringing up different aspects of this. According to the Chittamatrans, the final root of cyclic existence is the conception that object and subject are different entities. This is the subtlest and strongest of all misconceptions, and when it is destroyed, all misconceptions are destroyed. Okay, so we said some Chittamatrans, the followers of scripture following a Sangha, said that there were three final vehicles, right? So the hearer arhats, solitary realizer arhats, they've achieved their own goal and they won't go any further according to one part of the Chittamatrans. Some of the Chittamatrans say no, they will be awakened, but still they've achieved their goal. Have they escaped from cyclic existence? Yeah, they've achieved nirvana. But here it's saying, according to Chittamatrans, the final root of cyclic existence is the conception that object and subject are different entities. This is the subtlest and strongest of all misconceptions. And when it is destroyed, all misconceptions are destroyed. So who realizes the emptiness of subject and object being different entities? Do the hearers realize that? No, they achieve their nirvana by realizing the subtle selflessness of persons. And the solitary realizers perhaps have a subtler realization than that. But it's only the bodhisattvas will achieve enlightenment that realize the difference in entity between subject and object. The emptiness of that subject and object are one entity, right? But here it says the final root of cyclic existence is the conception that object and subject are different entities. That's the root of cyclic existence. Generally, in Prasangika, what do we say the root of cyclic existence is? What? Ignorance grasping at inherent existence, or the wrong view of the transitory collection that perceives an inherently existent person, right? So if this is the final root of cyclic existence, how did the Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas escape from cyclic existence? Because they don't realize that. Okay, I'm not sure. What do you think? Anyone have an idea? Cece, you have an idea? Here it says the final root. So there is a root of cyclic existence. It's sufficient for the Shravakas and the Pratika Buddhas to realize the selflessness of person to escape from cyclic existence. But if you go further, what was the cause of that misconception that there is a self-supporting, substantially existent person? The cause of that is this misapprehension about subject and object being different entities. But you don't have to go that far to escape from cyclic existence. You can just realize the selflessness of persons for the followers of a Sangha. Okay. I don't know how much of this. Maybe a couple more things here worth going over. Did you follow what I was just saying? So I was asking, here the text says, according to the Chittamatrans, the final root of cyclic existence is the conception that object and subject are different entities. That's a misconception, right? That's the root of cyclic existence. Like the root of cyclic existence for Prasangika is the ignorance that grasps to inherent existence, or the wrong view of the transitory collection that grasps to an inherently existent I. According to the Chittamatrans, the final root of cyclic existence is the conception, so that's the grasping, ignorance, that object and subject are different entities. This is the subtlest and strongest of all misconceptions, and when it is destroyed, all misconceptions are destroyed. So how do the Shravakas and solitary realizers reach their nirvana, which is the end of cyclic existence, if the final root of cyclic existence is the grasping that subject and object are different entities, because they don't realize that necessarily? So the resolution was, which said just a minute ago, leaving imprint in your mind, saying again, although that's the final root of cyclic, that grasping to that difference of subject and object as being different entities, that's the final root. That's the cause of all the misconceptions. Slightly grosser misconception that there is a self which is self-supporting, substantially existent. Realizing that is sufficient to get out of cyclic existence. But still they say the cause of that misconception is the grasping that subject and object are different entities. Did you get it? Cece? You don't get it? You don't understand? So, to cut your own bondage to cyclic existence, you have to realize at least that a person is empty of being self-supporting, substantially existent. But that's not the subtle most ignorance. There's subtler ignorance. The ignorance that grasps the subjects and objects being different entities, right? But you don't have to realize that subtle, you don't have to eliminate that subtler ignorance to escape from cyclic existence. That ignorance might still be on your continuum. This is according to the Chittamatrans. Still, that subtler one is said to be the root of cyclic, the final root of cyclic existence, because if you were to meditate on that, you would eliminate the grosser one also, the grosser conception that a person is self-supporting, substantially existent. Get it now? Okay. Something to think about. When my teacher Lama Yeshe first taught us emptiness at Kopan, I think it was 1975, he taught, the very first text he taught, because up till then we'd always had courses, every year we'd come back to Kopan for another Kopan course, thinking that Lama would teach some more advanced subject, would always be the same Lam Rim. Lama Yeshe and Lama Sopa said, until you realize, you know, the meditations of the Lam Rim, you have to hear again and again. It's not something that's just intellectual, you know, you can count off the eight freedoms and the 10 endowments, or, you know, all of these different outlines, but you haven't actualized them. So he didn't teach the details about emptiness from the beginning. And when he did, the very first text he taught was it Madhyanta Vibhagna, the discrimination of the middle and extreme. One of the texts that Asanga brought back from Tushita Heaven, mainly talking about the Chittamatra view. Lama was taught first, so as a very good stepping stone, because the Chittamatra view is very subtle, much different, much more different than the Hinayana views, you know, of how phenomena exist. So one of the things we've been talking about here again and again is their view, the subtle selflessness of phenomena, is that phenomena don't exist the way that they appear as separate and cut off from the consciousness that perceives them, that phenomena are actually, let's say, external objects are actually the same entity of the consciousness that perceives them. This also has to do, there's a grosser version of that that's called the gross, that's called the subtle selflessness of phenomena for Chittamatra. Do you know what the gross selflessness of phenomena is for Chittamatra? Maybe did some of you study tenets before? Who studied tenets before? Maybe you're afraid to say. You don't want to admit that you studied. You're studying tenets now. So what is the gross selflessness of phenomena? Either of you, you back then. Have you heard? Is it one of the questions that's come up? Oh, she's showing you her notes. Mm-hmm. CC, KK, SK. Like everything here is. When people refer to, I've noticed when people refer to the deity Yamataka, they say, why? Or Vajrayogini, they say, VY. Everything is abbreviated here in Singapore. So Ching Ching is CC. Either you know what the gross selflessness of phenomena is for Chittamatra? Doesn't exist? What? Doesn't exist in your mind. Say again? Yes. Okay. So we say that this gross selflessness of phenomena for Chittamatra is that phenomena do not exist as the natural bases for names that are imputed upon them. Have you heard, does that ring a bell with you now? So that is said to be, from that point, if you understand that, that's more easily understood than the fact that phenomena do not exist as different entities from the mind. But that second, the more subtle, can be derived from this. So I think it's the solitary, I think the solitary realizers realize, according to some of the Chittamatrans, the solitary realizers realize the gross selflessness of phenomena. Hearers realize the lack of a self-supporting, substantial, existent person. The Pratika Buddhas realize that and the gross selflessness of phenomena. And the Bodhisattvas realize both the lack of a self-supporting, substantial, existent person and the gross selflessness of phenomena, and also realize the subtle selflessness of phenomena, that phenomena don't exist as separate entities from the mind. So one can be derived from the other. The fact that phenomena don't exist as naturally, don't abide naturally, as the bases for their names. What does that mean? Okay, I'm coming here. Let's see. I think there'll be a little explanation here. Okay, so we talked about the Bodhisattvas meditate on this subtle selflessness of phenomena. Included in the obstructions to simultaneous and direct cognition of all phenomena, all objects of knowledge, together with the conception of object and subject being different entities, is the conception that phenomena naturally exist as the grounds or bases of engagement in names. That's what I'm just talking about, okay? So this is another, what the Chittamatrans say are obstructions to omniscience. It's interesting. For the Prasangika, is ignorance an obstruction to omniscience? Good. First you said no, and then you're thinking, maybe. Do you know? For Prasangika, is ignorance that grasps to phenomena being truly existent, is that an obstruction to omniscience? Pardon? Must be, lah? What do you think? I'm plumbing the depths of your memories or what you heard. Generally, for Prasangika, grasping to true existence is a klesha, afflicted obstruction. What are the obstructions to omniscience? More subtle things. They say just to escape from cyclic existence, you have to realize that phenomena are empty, inherent existence, right? That's not considered to be an obstruction to omniscience. Just realizing that, even the hearers and solitary realizers realize that phenomena are empty of inherent existence from the Prasangika point of view. For the Prasangika, the obstructions to omniscience are more subtle things. The seeds that cause phenomena to appear to be inherently existent to us, just the appearance, is an obstruction to omniscience. Other kinds of things like that. But for the Chittamatrans, the subtle grasping to emptiness of phenomena, to subtle grasping that forms and the form realizing consciousnesses are different entities, believing that, realizing that is called an obstruction to omniscience, or that conception is called an obstruction to omniscience. Why? Because you can achieve liberation simply by realizing the person is empty of being self-supporting, substantially existent. But to obtain omniscience, you have to realize that forms and form-realizing consciousnesses are empty of being different entities. So that kind of, for them, emptiness, for Chittamatra, emptiness of phenomena is an obstruction to omniscience. Whereas for Prasangika, realizing emptiness of phenomena, meaning different, emptiness of phenomena being inherently existent, that's just called the lesser obstruction, the obstruction to liberation, or the afflicted obstruction. You following? No? Okay. So generally, when we follow the spiritual path, there are different obstructions that prevent us from making realizations. Two main goals of the Buddhist path, we'll say two main goals, are nirvana and enlightenment. Nirvana and bodhi. Okay. Generally, the goal of the Hinayana paths, the Shravakas and the Pratika Buddhas, is to achieve nirvana, escape from cyclic existence. They have compassion for sentient beings, even from their point of view, great compassion. But to get out of this place, samsara, is of utmost importance. What prevents them from getting out of cyclic existence? From the point of view of the different schools have different ideas. From the lower schools, let's say the Vaibhashika, the Sratrantika, and even the Chittamatra here, what prevents you from getting out of cyclic existence is grasping at a self of persons. That ego, the sense of ego, gives rise to your anger, attachment, creating all the karma that again impels you into cyclic existence, right? So that the obstructions that prevent you from attaining a liberation are called that, the obstructions to liberation. They're also called afflicted obstructions because they're usually delusions. This delusion that's grasping to a self of persons for the lower schools. When you talk about the Chittamatra, they say that that's true also, but they say that there are subtler obstructions to the goal of omniscience, to Buddhahood. something more subtle than grasping to a self of persons that prevents you from reaching that final goal of bodhi or enlightenment. And that is the grasping to phenomena as being distant and cut off from consciousness, as being external objects that are different entities from the mind. That appears to our mind, appears to our senses, because of habitual, you know, familiarity with it from beginningless time. That's called the selflessness of phenomena, and that is called, for the Chittamatra, that is called an obstruction to omniscience. Because you can attain liberation simply by realizing selflessness of persons. Okay. Maybe it is no more clear than before, but okay, maybe a little bit. So there's two kinds of obstructions. Generally, all the schools from Chittamatra onward say there are these two kinds of obstructions. Why did the lower schools not say there are two kinds of obstructions? The Vaibhashika and Svatrantha? Because for them, there's one obstruction, the realization, the grasping to a self of persons, and the different goals, hearers, nirvana, solitary realizers of nirvana, and enlightenment, the goal of the bodhisattva, all those goals are differentiated by the accumulation of merit that the individual has accumulated. Of course, they have more intelligence and more powers, but mainly by how much merit they accumulated, not by their realization of selflessness. But from the Chittamatra onward, we're saying, actually, the realizations are differentiated a little bit differently. The hearers and solitary realizers realize something less subtle than what the bodhisattvas realize. The bodhisattvas realize this subtle selflessness of phenomena. Maybe the solitary realizers realize the gross selflessness of phenomena, and the hearers realize just the selflessness of the person. That's sufficient to get out of cyclic existence. So when the text said that the root, the final root of cyclic existence for Chittamatra is grasping to phenomena as being different entities from the consciousness, that's the final root. You still have you still can escape from cyclic existence by realizing the selflessness of persons. Where did that selflessness of the sense of a self of persons arise? It arises from that final root. But you don't have to eliminate the final root to get out of cyclic existence. You have to eliminate that final root to achieve omniscience. You can achieve nirvana simply by realizing selflessness of persons. Okay. Some people are nodding sagely. Some people are... You two ladies, does it make sense? You guys are studying for the final. Are you also studying for the final exam? No, you. Yeah. Are you studying for the exam too? No. Okay. Just anyone else studying for the final? Okay. So, but they should have a good review for you. Who knows? Might be on the exam. So included in the obstructions to omniscience. In other words, to simultaneous and direct cognition of all objects of knowledge, along with the conception of object and subject being different entities, that's the subtle selflessness of phenomena, is this gross selflessness of phenomena, the conception that phenomena naturally exist as grounds or bases of engagement in names. The non-existence of objects as natural bases of engagement in names is a selflessness of phenomena that is, here he's saying, that is as subtle as the non-existence of subject and object as different entities, but is easier to realize. So in some ways called the gross selflessness of phenomena. An understanding of it serves as a means to entering into the understanding of non-duality. Here for Chittamatra, non-duality makes sense because there's no duality between object and subject. They're one entity. So it has its... In all of the different philosophical schools, it seems, non-duality has slightly different flavor, different meaning. So you have to be careful to understand what you're talking about, what a text says, what the text is talking about when it says non-duality. In refuting that phenomena naturally exist as the bases of names, So we're refuting that. It appears to our consciousness and to our mind that phenomena are naturally existing as the bases of their names. To refute that, the Chittamatrans are not merely saying that the appearing objects of thought, what's the appearing object of thought? Generic images, right? The mental image. That's the appearing object. That's the main object that appears. Also, when you think about something, the object is said also to appear, like your mother is said to appear if you think of your mother, although she might be somewhere else, she might be passed away. That is said to be an appearing object, but it's not the main appearing object. Main appearing object is the generic image through which you understand your mother or you understand the object. So the Chittamatrans are not merely saying that the appearing objects of thought, meaning generalities, generic images, mental images, do not naturally exist because of depending on thought. Now, what do mental images have to do with this naming? Because all naming process, when we give names, all depends on thought. You can't give a name without having some mental process. Your eyes don't give names. Your eyes doesn't think cup. Cup is being thought by your mental consciousness, right? That process of giving names is a conceptual process, so it depends on mental images. So the Chittamatrans, in refuting that phenomena naturally exists as bases of names, the Chittamatrans are not merely saying that the appearing objects of thought, the mental images, do not naturally exist because of depending on thought. So they're not naturally existing for Chittamatra. For the Sautrantikas, because the Sautrantikas propound such, they believe that meaning generalities, the mental images, do not naturally exist. Why don't they naturally exist? Because they're just the objects of thought. They're not the objects of any kind of direct perception. They're permanent objects. They're permanent phenomena. And here, a subtle selflessness of phenomena must be more subtle than anything found in the lower systems of tenets. So this proposition that this gross selflessness of phenomena, that phenomena, outer objects, do not exist naturally as the bases of names, is something more subtle than what the Sautrantikas mean. Nor are the Chittamatrans saying that forms and so forth do not naturally exist, because for them, forms naturally exist. They do have a natural existence. They are not different entities from the consciousness, but they do have a natural existence. Forms do naturally, truly, inherently, and ultimately exist for Chittamatra. Did you know that? For Chittamatra, forms do inherently exist. Pardon? Mind inherently exists, right? Forms do naturally, truly, inherently, and ultimately exist, because if they did not, they would not exist at all. For the Chittamatrans, the Prasangika view that objects do not naturally, truly, inherently, and ultimately exist, the Chittamatrans think that's a denial of phenomena. If impermanent things did not naturally exist, they would be totally non-existent. You know, this is of the different philosophical schools that argue with the Prasangika, Majjhimaka, mainly it's Chittamatra, because the view propounded by Nargarjuna, the Prasangika view, was more or less contemporary with the Sangha. So there was some kind of debate between those two schools, mainly Chittamatra and the Majjhimaka schools, especially Prasangika. So the Chittamatra is saying, if phenomena didn't truly exist, they wouldn't exist at all. They say they have to truly exist. when the Chittamatrans speak of objects as not being naturally bases of names, then they're meaning something else. They base this on the adventitious relationship between objects and names. You know what adventitious means? Adventitious means just by accident, not permanent. That the adventitious relationship between objects and names. How do names come about? Why is this called a cup? What is it? How do you say this in Chinese? What? Bei? Two syllables? Bei, what? Beizi. Beizi. Tibetan, maybe Kayu, I don't know, something. The different languages have different names. Why are they given? Why is this called a this is called an iPad, but let's say like a computer. Why is a computer called a computer? It was someone gave that name because at one point it was used for computing, right? Names are adventitious. Sometimes someone gives a name of something for some reason and it becomes popular convention, but the name wasn't there from the very beginning, right? That's what it means. Adventitious relationship between objects and names, and between names and objects. For instance, when an ordinary being's eye consciousness perceives a pot, let's call this a pot not only appears to be a bulbous thing able to hold fluid, that's what appears to the eye consciousness, but also the bulbous thing appears to be the basis of the designation pot. It's very, actually at this point, very subtle. It doesn't just mean that we misconceive and think that the name adheres in the object as soon as you see the object that you would know the name. Something more subtle than that. Oh, by the way, you know the definition of pot in Tibetan? We're in some ritual we were doing recently. We talk about the pot as having a flat base, a fat belly, and the ability to hold water. A protruding lip. You know, sometimes a vase has this lip coming down. So some people joke and say, oh, no, that's the definition of a geshe. Flat bottom, fat belly, able to hold water, retreating. Just an inside Buddhist joke, okay? Vedra's joke. Now you can joke with the geshe sometimes. that's kind of the definition of pot. So when an ordinary being's eye consciousness perceives a pot, the pot not only appears to be a bulbous thing that is able to hold water, but also the bulbous thing appears to be the basis of the designation pot, the name pot. It appears to be naturally the basis of the designation pot. The bulbous thing seems to be the basis of the designation pot by way of its own being and not just established so by verbal convention. That's the way that phenomena appear to our eye consciousness. After an eye consciousness perceives the object, you know, you see this thing, then thought imputes, this is a pot, without the intervention of any other thought. The sense consciousness alone is able to draw thought into imputing, this is a pot, without the aid of intervening reflection. This is a very subtle point, but this is called... And this one is called the gross selflessness of phenomena. Therefore, when another asks what the expression pot means, people do not say a pot means that, people do not say it is the pot that is only nominally imputed to the bulbous thing capable of holding water. They say a pot is the bulbous thing that is capable of holding water. They don't say it's that which is only nominally imputed. They say that which is the bulbous thing, as though the bulbous thing able to hold water is inherently the basis of the name, pot. Sound familiar? Did you study this before when you studied Chittamatra? Yeah, okay. So due to previous conditioning, objects falsely appear to sense consciousness as naturally bases of names, and then thought, assenting to this appearance, falsely conceives them likewise. This is what the Chittamatrans assert. Okay, this is little easier to understand. In one way, it's sort of as subtle as the fact that forms and form-realizing consciousness are empty of being different entities, but it's easier to understand this, as said. And from one, you can prove the other, supposedly. How does that, say again, how does that relate to the Prasangika position that... that there is a naturally existent pot out there?
How is that...
A phenomena for Chittamatra. So you're saying the Prasangika view is that there is an inherently existent pot out there?
The emptiness of that.
Yeah, the emptiness of inherently existent, that there is not an inherently existent pot out there. So here we're talking about two different things. And it's in some ways it's said that this selflessness of phenomena for Chittamatra, this expression of selflessness of phenomena, I'm calling the gross, sometimes it could be called the subtle. These two are said to be equally subtle, that form and form-realizing consciousness are empty of being different substances, and that forms do not naturally abide as the bases of their names. They're said to be equally subtle. Sometimes one is called gross, sometimes the other is called gross. So the thing about the names is a little bit different than the Prasangika position, quite a bit different, but it acts as a stepping stone. And it's said that that understanding, on the basis of understanding that phenomena do not exist naturally as the bases of their names, although that doesn't mean, it's not realizing that they are not inherently existent, because Chittamatra believes they are inherently existent, but they do not naturally exist as the bases of their names that are imputed upon them. A little bit different, but it's said that on the basis of that understanding, you can make very high realizations, even in Tantra, even, I think, Lama Tsongkhapa said, maybe even achieving the, what is it called, the impure illusory body or something like that. So there's something similar to the Prasangika view, but there's no way through understanding this view about names that you could even be liberated from Prasangika view, that you could even be liberated from cyclic existence, let alone achieve omniscience. Okay, this is the Chittamatra view. So let me read a little bit further. Due to previous conditioning, objects falsely appear to sense consciousness as if naturally bases of names, and then thought assenting to this appearance falsely conceives them likewise. Yes. You know, they appear that way. That's kind of like the appearance of inherent existence, and then thought conceives them. That's right. That's similar to the Prasangika view that phenomena appear to be inherently existent, and then thought grasps to that as true. Right? It's a similarity there. The Sautrantikas, going back to Sautrantikas, say that both the appearance of objects is naturally bases of names, and the conception of them are so, the conception of them as so, as being naturally bases of names, are correct. Sautrantikas, we're going back to Hinayana, because sense objects are truly existent external objects, and when they appear to a faultless sense consciousness, their very mode of being must appear just as it is. Still, the Sautrantikas We're getting different systems here. We're talking about Satrantika, Chittamatra, and Prasangika. Still, Satrantika say that mental images which appear to internal thought do not naturally exist. They're artificially existent, right? And are only a reification of what depends on thought for its existence. Okay, I won't go into that. In the Chittamatra system, forms and so forth are not external objects, right? Chittamatra forms and so forth are not external objects to the mind that perceives them. They're not external, they're not different entities. They are external objects. They're called external objects because they're not internal objects, but they're not external to the mind that conceives them, that perceives them. In the Chittamatra system, forms are and so forth are not external objects. They appear to be external objects through the force of predispositions accumulated through beginningless conditioning to the naming of objects. So for the Chittamatra, they're saying this appearance of this dichotomy, this duality of subject and object, whereas they're actually one coming from the same seed. The conception of them being different comes about, and the appearance of them comes about through beginningless conditioning to the naming of objects. So it's for Chittamatra, there's a relationship between these two gross and subtle selflessnesses of phenomena. One sort of arises from the other. Forms are only of the nature of inner consciousness, right? They're not different entities from the consciousness that realize them, but they appear to be natural bases of names through the force of predispositions for expression. We have seeds in our mind to give names to things, sort of these seeds or predispositions. Therefore, the appearance of forms as naturally existent bases of names is not suitable to arise from the way things are without depending on establishment by names and thoughts. Don't worry, I don't expect you to understand. It's difficult. Otherwise, the fact that forms are the basis of names would not depend on a consciousness, in which case forms would be different entities for perceiving consciousness. Okay, I won't go into more detail. Let me just go through that. So this is worth knowing that there are two expressions about the selflessness of phenomena for Chittamatra. One says that phenomena are empty of being empty of naturally being the bases of the names that are imputed upon them, which they apparently appear to have because of seeds in our mind, predispositions in our minds from giving names in previous lives. And the more subtle version is that phenomena appear to be different entities from the consciousness that perceive them. That's generally the origin of the name Chittamatra, right? Chittamatra means mind only. Phenomena are only the nature of the mind. It doesn't mean that, in a certain sense, only, although we say that these objects exist, the objects that we see exist, Chittamatra says they exist, and they even inherently exist, but they don't exist as objects as they appear to be different entities from the mind. This particular realization is very, very powerful, even though, is it true? Are phenomena, like say this cup, is actually the same entity as the consciousness that perceives it for Prasangika? It's not just like that's true and Prasangika proposes something in addition to that that's more subtle. Prasangika would say this is not true. Phenomena do exist as external objects to the mind, different entities from the mind. But still, by meditating on that, the Yogacara system, you can overcome attachment to things. You know, it's just mind. It's just the nature of my mind. It's very, very powerful. Okay, another point. Remember we talked about partless particles in the Vaibhashika system, Satransika system? For the Vaibhashika, what were ultimate truths for Vaibhashika? Do you remember? Things that could not be destroyed, that the perception of which was not destroyed when you either broke them, like breaking a pot, or that could not be, the perception of which would not be destroyed when you analyzed it into its parts. Those are ultimate truths. For the Vaibhashika, the ultimate truths were partless particles, partless moments of time, partless instants of consciousness, and so forth, partless things. So the Chittamatrans refute the view that material objects are constructed from the amassing of partless particles. They say there's no partless particles. Remember, I might have mentioned at the time there's a proof that there are no partless particles. Even someone asked me, what is that proof? I said, wait. So the Chittamatrans point out that if a partless particle is surrounded by other particles, partless or not, let's say this is, I brought some coffee down in case if you're really tired, you can have a sip. Let's say here's another partless particle. If you're going to make something out of partless particles, you have to accumulate them, right? Here's another partless particle. Here's another partless particle. There are going to be partless particles in all different sides of it, right? So if a partless particle is surrounded by other particles, the place where one of the surrounding particles, touches the one in the center would not be the place where the others touch. This is touching over here. This is touching on this side, on the right side to me, your left side. This is touching to my left side. This is touching to that side over there, the back side. This is maybe another particle here is touching this side. So that center partless particle would have sides, would have directions. From Buddhist point of view, therefore it has parts. It has a eastern part, a northern part, a western part, you know, up part, and so forth. Thus there would be touched and untouched parts. Or if the supposed six particles surrounding the center one all touch the same place on the central particle, then nothing could be larger than one partless particle. Oh, do you know that off the top of your mind? If you surround something in all directions, how many sides does it, let's say a cube. You know a cube? How many sides does a cube have? Eight? Six. That may come to your mind right away. So if you think of the cube around the sides, there are four faces, one face on the top, one face on the bottom. It's kind of like what we're talking about here. So there's six, you could say there's six surrounding particles. As though, even though it's not assuming this is a cube, but just to like to say the directions, one in these four locations around horizontally here, and one above and one below. So if they touch different places, then it's not partless because it has different directional parts. If all the surrounding particles touch the same place, then this particle really has no dimension. The partless particle not only is partless, it has no dimension at all. Everything is touching the same place. And you couldn't accumulate partless particles to make a gross object because they would all be, they'd all be touching. You put another particle there, it's touching the same place. You'd never be able to get further away from the center. You follow? Do you follow? No? No. Little bit, yeah. Say, for instance, if you were to suppose that something not only was partless, but you know that if you put something on this side, it touches the same place on the particle as if you put something on this side, right? It essentially means the two particles from the side here, they're touching the same place. They'd essentially be touching each other too. If they're partless particles, then if you put other particles on either side of them, They would be touching each other. You'd never be able to extend and make something bigger from partless particles. Okay? Does that make sense, Sweekim?
Yeah.
Nothing could be larger than one partless particle if that were the case. Some respond saying that the surrounding particles do not touch the center particle. This is the Vaibhashika is answering. You say, oh, no, there's no problem. They don't touch the center particle. But, But it is answered that nevertheless, one of the surrounders would be closer to one side. So, some say they don't actually touch the center particle like this, but there's some gap. But still, this particle would be closer to this side where it is than this other particle on the other side. That would be what Chittamatra would respond if Vaibhashika said they don't actually touch. And thus, the center particle would still have to have sides and thus parts. Okay, so that's the is that going to be a question on your final exam? What's the proof that there are no partless particles? Chittamatra proof. It's very, very simple, right? Makes sense? Okay, another point. Furthermore, a spot of blue and an eye consciousness that apprehends it, right, again, are not different entities because the observation of one by valid cognition is pervaded by being the observation of the other by valid cognition. This is what the Chittamatra says. What is this talking about? This is talking about self-cognizing awareness. So when consciousness perceives something, I say blue, color blue, or this little fish, this orange fish, when eye consciousness perceives it, We know that we saw the object. We know that the object is verified by valid cognition, by the consciousness itself. What verifies that you saw the object? Maybe you verify that there is an object there, the fish or the car that you see, because you saw it with a valid cognition. How do you verify the cognition itself? This is where the Chittamatra says you need a self-cognizing awareness that knows the consciousness, that's simultaneous with the consciousness, also simultaneous cause and effect. It's knowing the consciousness at the same moment the consciousness is knowing the object. So a spot of blue and an eye consciousness that apprehends this are not different entities. They use this reasoning of self-consciousness to prove it because the observation of one by valid cognizer is coextensive with the observation of the other by a valid cognizer. In other words, whenever an eye consciousness observes an object, a self-consciousness observes the eye consciousness. Right? For the Chittamatrans and some Sautrantikas, every consciousness is self-conscious, self-aware, because later, when an object that was seen is remembered, one remembers not only the object, but one also remembers the subject. One remembers seeing it. Do you ever say that? Oh, I saw that. You know, you're remembering not only the object, but you're remembering the seeing. So some of the Sautrantikas and the Chittamatrans say that proves for them that there has to be something called self-awareness, self-consciousness, that is a faculty of every consciousness that is pointed inwards. In other words, it is knowing the act of knowing. It's not knowing the object that is known by the main consciousness, like, say, the cup or the fish. It is just knowing that you knew. So you were able to remember not only the object, but you remember that you actually perceived the object. These are kind of dry bones, huh? Geshe Zobi is chewing dry bones. So for some of you who've heard this before, maybe a little bit clearer, maybe not, than it was before. Some of you who have not heard it before, maybe you feel, how could I ever understand this? There's some that may already, some of you out there that are already bodhisattvas, this is old stuff, you know. But it's like, I use this example several times, it's like painting, you get some furniture from, was it IKEA? Do you buy furniture from IKEA? Or is that too quiche? Is that fashionable to buy stuff from IKEA? It is? Okay. Can you get furniture that's unpainted? Some is just raw wood? Okay. So you decide to paint it. You put on some paint and you let it dry and you think, oh, it should be, well, not, after a half an hour, it looks like the color is faded somewhat. Why? Because the paint has absorbed into the wood. Usually what painters do is they put on a primer coat first, right? Do you know what I mean? They put on a layer, even white or something first that sinks into the wood. Then when you put in the actual coat, it's more on the surface, it stands out. So when we hear things now, it's almost like putting on a primer coat in our mind. After you might, right now you might say, I kind of understand, and then 20 minutes later it's like, what did he say? You know, it's like it's... But there's some imprint in your mind. As you hear this again, when Ken Rinpoche and other people talk about these subjects again in the future, on the basis of having this imprint, this primer coat. You know, I've applied the primer coat. Anyway, then later, it will become more clear. You know, it will be. So don't worry. Okay, I won't go into any more about that. There's more detail about that, but. So, mind only. So remember, in the Lankavatara and in the Dashabhumika Sutra, do you know the Dashabhumika? Do you know what dasha means? You know what dasha means. We said the Dashadika Dharmapala. 10 directional Dharma protection. Dasha means 10. The Dasha Bhumika Sutra, you know what that is? The Sutra of the 10 Bhumis. It's a Mahayana Sutra that Chandrakirti relied on when he talked about in his Majjhimavatara, when he talked about the 10 Bhumis that the Bodhisattvas go on. Are there 10 Bhumis or only 6 Bhumis? 10 Bhumis, right? That correspond to 10 perfections. The first 6 bhumis are the first 6 perfections that you know, and then there's some more subtle perfections, perfection of prayer and power and skillful means and what? Jnana or gnosis, the 10th bhumi. More subtle than prajna, than regular wisdom, right? So this term comes up, mind only, Chitta Matra comes up both in the Lankavatara Sutra and the Dashabhumika Sutra, other places the Buddha said that. So that's the basis for the Chitta Matra view, the mind only. Prasangikas, however, say that the Buddha set forth a teaching about mind only which was not meant to be literal. He was teaching this to overcome certain trainees' attachment to forms. Remember I said that by understanding the Chittamatra view, you could overcome your attachment to, let's say, a beautiful form. So the Prasangikas say the Buddha set forth a non-literal teaching of mind only, Chittamatra, in order to overcome certain trainees' attachments to form. The basis in his thought was the fact that mind is the principal creator of everything. When we say that mind that all is mind only. The three realms are mind only. That means mind is the principal creator. That's to help overcome the conception in people's minds that, for instance, Ishvara is the creator of the world, or something else is the creator of the world. Is your mind the creator of the world? How is the mind creator of the world? Well, in different ways. Our collective karma, you know how the universe, you know, we say that this is an external world to us, according to the Prasangika, right? How does this external world come about? The collective karma of the beings of similar type that inhabit this world system, that collective karma is what is, this world system is the environmental effect of that collective karma. Our own environmental effects of our own individual karma is whether you live in a muddy place or a dangerous place or, you know, quiet place or nice-smelling place or bad-smelling place. The environment, you have your own environmental effect, but there's an environmental effect of the collective karma of the sentient beings, which is the outer environment that comes about because of our collective karma. Usually in the Abhidharma Kosha, there's a famous verse that says, all the world and the inhabitants therein arise from karma. Yeah. Karma is the cause. So in a certain sense, mind creates karma. Even though you create karma with your body, you step on an ant, or you give generosity with your hand, or you create karma with your speech, all of that is motivated by the mind. The mind is the principal creator of the karma. So the outer world, in a sense, has been created by the mind. According to Prasangika, the mind is the principal creator of everything because sentient beings accumulate predisposing potencies through their actions, and these actions are directed by mental motivation, karmic seeds. These seeds or potencies are what create not only their own lives, but also the physical world about them, right? It creates our collective karma, the environmental effect, when that ripens, is the world generating and being populated and slowly disintegrating and disappearing and so forth due to the karma, collective karma. All environments are formed by karma. That is, actions and the potencies they establish. Our actions leave imprints, karmic seeds in our consciousness, our collective consciousnesses, and those seeds, when ripening, create the outer world. The wind, sun, earth, trees, what is enjoyed, what is used, suffered, all these are produced from actions. Potencies on the mind of each person in combination with those of similar beings create the very substance of their world systems. This is collective karma, right? The Prasangika assertion is not like the Chittamatra one, that a potency or seed simultaneously creates a cognizing subject and a cognized object. Rather, the physical world is constructed through the former actions of beings of similar type, and that world is conventionally an entity external to the consciousness which perceives it. Because the world of objects acts as a cause of consciousness, affecting it in various ways. Okay? So for Prasangika, like in Chandrakirti, when in his Majjhimavatara, there's a section refuting the Chittamatra and saying that when the Buddha said Chittamatra, mind only, he was, in one sense, he was referring to this, that mind is the principal creator of the world, so that it is mind only. This helps to overcome misconceptions. Still, the mind, the motivator of actions, is the principal creator. The Prasangika view, like that of the Chittamatra, is of a world inextricably involved with the person. Mahayanists practice the bodhisattva deeds of compassion with a view toward creation of pure lands for temporary emanations, for nirmanakaya, right? You know what pure lands are? I sometimes think Christ was a bodhisattva. Various reasons, many reasons in my mind to believe that. Others do also. His teachings in general, mainly teaching between method and wisdom. What did he mainly teach, do you think? If you were to see him, assume that he was actually teaching sort of bodhisattva path. Between method and wisdom, method, really, how to deal with the world, mainly talking about compassion, giving himself for others. Didn't teach explicitly so much wisdom of emptiness. Well, you didn't say emptiness, but you know, you can understand. Also talk about karma. Ye reap what ye sow, I think is the best biblical phrase that kind of explains the meaning of karma. Did you have a question? No, you just didn't. So Mahayanists practice the bodhisattva deeds of compassion with a view toward creation of pure lands for temporary emanation bodies who are surrounded by both common beings and superiors. They also create karma to create a highest pure land. It's called Akanista, where they manifest enlightenment and where their Sambhogakaya will reside. So I sometimes think that Christ was a bodhisattva, and when he talked about those of him, of his disciples, or those who followed him that had faith in him, would be born in heaven with him, I think there is a Christian pure land. And who knows? I mean, completely crazy. But that, I think that if you had, you know, unshakable faith in Christ, the same way that to be born in Amitabha's pure land, what do you have to have? You have to have pure view and a karmic connection, maybe reciting a mantra or other kinds of things. Not that different, is it? You have faith in Christ, you know, you create actions to be in heaven with him and his father. Okay, so what is bodhisattvas, they have various reasons for collecting merit in order to have a nirmanakaya eventually, to create the form bodies, nirmanakaya and sambhogakaya, but also they create the environment of a pure land, both a pure land for their nirmanakaya emanations and a pure land for their sambhogakaya emanations. It is in these lands that one provides the conditions for others to advance on the path, including the land on which they stand. The pure lands are actually created by the individual environmental effect, let's say, of the bodhisattva's karma ripening, which other beings then can inhabit. Even though they are not out of a cyclic existence, for some period of time they can experience that pure land without the arisal of delusions and therefore be protected from falling into the lower realms where they're in the pure land. You know, when we talk about pure lands, right? Perhaps it could be said that development of the ability to produce pure lands is a conscious sublimation of the uncontrolled process of the creation of less suitable worlds by contaminated actions. What does that mean? So what we're doing collectively now with our contaminated minds, we create the karma for further world systems in the future, which are samsaric world systems, not pure lands. But the bodhisattva sublimates that energy with pure karma, creating the karma for a pure land, mainly by his or her own effort, not just the collective karma of others. But that's why the bodhisattvas have to create so much virtuous karma. Because it's not the collective karma that's ripening in the pure land. It's just his or hers. Both the Chittamatrans and the Prasangikas accept roughly the same presentation of phenomena, but they disagree on their nature. For instance, both schools accept that when different types of beings look at a bowl of fluid, do you know this example? the fluid actually becomes different things. For a human, it is, let's say, cool water, or in this case, boiled water, now at room temperature. Okay. So to human, sees water here. What does a hungry ghost see? Do you know? If they were to, you know a hungry ghost, Preta? What did they see if they see this? What? Fire? They see pus and blood, some kind of liquid, but not nice cool water. What does a deva see when they see this? Nectar, right? Ambrosia. Right. What's the Sanskrit word? We say these words, nectar, ambrosia. Do you know what it is? The Sanskrit word? Amrita, right? Amrita. A is a negative particle, in this case again. Mrita, you know what mrita means? You don't know. Mrita means death. Amrita would mean what? Deathless. So that's the drink of the gods imbues them with longevity, with the deathless state. That's the actual word that we translate as nectar or ambrosia, amrita. In the Tibetan, we say dutsi. You know, dutsi ribu or dutsi. So the god would perceive amrita. For a hungry ghost, pus and blood, and so forth. For the Chittamatrans, this in itself proves, for them, that fact proves that there are no external objects. The very world of objects is under the influence of the mind, changing in entity due to the presence of different types of beings. So when the Preta sees this, what he or she sees, the female preachers, right? Also, there are also female. I'm saying them also female preachers because in some of the famous sutras, dharanis, where the preachers come in is when, say, for instance, Shariputra and Mahamoggallana are sitting discussing the Dharma, and one female preta appears to them because they have psychic powers. They can see pretas. We can't see the pretas. And she's screaming and in incredible distress. Everything they try to do to help just makes matters worse. So they go to the Buddha and ask what to do. The Buddha gives some ritual to do for her. There's several things. Also, Ananda. You know Ananda? Who's Ananda? The principal helper of the Buddha, his servant, right? Was one of the royal court also. I think it was Buddha's cousin, right? So Ananda at one point was meditating and a female preta came and was prophesied to him that in his next life he would be born as a preta. And he was like, whoa, here I am, the Buddha's disciple. I'm going to be born as a preta. And then like went to the Buddha and the preta had said, the only way you can avoid this is by making... But, you know, making offerings to some large number of pretas of as much food as in some large quantity of this measure in Magadha. There's in Magadha, central India, there was a certain measure of grain. So, like, had a whole bunch of bags of that grain to every, you know, numberless pretas. It's the only way he could avoid being born as a preta. So he went to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, chill out. Don't worry. He didn't say chill out, but equivalent, you know, don't worry. So the Buddha gave some ritual to do that would be essentially karmically equivalent to that, and that he could do in a short period of time to avoid that. So, yeah. So for the Prasangika, the reason that these different beings see different things, let's say for the Chittamatra, the reason a Preta sees pus and blood is because, again, the predisposition on their consciousness, the cognizing consciousness and the object that it perceives, the pus and blood, arise from one predisposition, one imprint on their mind, in relationship to this dependent origination, which has no natural kind of appearance. A human, due to their karma, the object appears differently because their predisposition is different. For the Prasangika, they say there's something different. They say that the reason that these different beings see different things is because of their karma, they see a different portion. There's a certain portion of the liquid here which is pus and blood now because of dependent arising, and the pretas see that portion of it. Did you know this? The humans see that portion of the liquid that is water, and the gods see that portion that is ambrosia or amrita. Yeah, that's what, well, in the Galukpa, at least, this is what Kedrup J, there's a famous text Kedrup J wrote called Dose of Emptiness. Maybe you saw Jose Cabazon, one of my friends, translated that text. Kedrup J was of the two disciples of Lama Tsongkhapa. So there's Lama Tsongkhapa there, right? So which one is Kedrup J on the bottom? The right, to Lama Tsongkhapa's right, or Lama Tsongkhapa's left? To his left, right? If you see in the Gompa on, was it level 4, there's a big statue. The Kedrup J is the one that looks with the eyebrows more wrathful. He's on Lama Tsongkhapa's left. Who's on the right? Gelsub Che. He looks very compassionate. He's supposed to be emanation of Chenrezig. Kedrup J is like emanation of Vajrapani. Lama Tsongkhapa is a body emanation of Manjushri. So they're like, they said all the Buddhas always appear with two main disciples. So Shakyamuni Buddha, and his right was what? Shariputra, and on his left, Mahamudgalanya was the one in magic power. It's kind of like Kedrup J also, the tantric aspect. Gelsub J, more the compassionate aspect, like Shariputra, more personable and so forth. So Kedrup J's text about subtle points about emptiness, illuminating doubts, called Dose of Emptiness. If you ever get a chance to read it, that's a good translation by Jose. Quite tough. Was it ever used in your class when Ken Rinpoche taught Prasangika? Does it ring a bell? A Dose of Emptiness. So in there he mentions that's from Prasangika point of view, that's why the pretas see something different. There actually is abiding there a certain portion of the dependent arising that the pretas perceive as pus. It's not as though there is inherently pus or inherently water or inherently amrita or something like that. Okay. There's a couple other points, but I will leave a couple minutes for questions. Next time, we have one more class that will have morning and afternoon, and next time we'll be talking about the Majjhimaka systems. A lot of it depends on understanding of these lower tenets, so we can go a little more quickly through that, and especially on the Prasangika view, we'll be talking about next time, the Svatantrika Majjhimaka. Remember, Svatantrika has two parts, at least Sautrantika, Svatantrika. My mala is slowly wearing off, I can say that. And the Yogacara Svatantrika. And the Prasangika mainly is just one, mainly one school. So before we end, any questions? Okay. Oh, I think that maybe, we'll just try it again, whether that works or not. I think they put the volume too high upstairs.
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah.
Remember the part where you where the Pasangika were trying to refute the Chitta Mantra when they say that the object and the consciousness appearing object, the cause and effect arises at the same time.
That's what Chittamatra says.
Yeah.
Right?
Why can't the cause be the cause of that seed in the mind that produces the consciousness? So if that's the case, then there will be a lack, right? Why should it be the object that produces that consciousness be the cause? Why can't it be the seed itself in the consciousness that produces that consciousness and also produce the object? So that seed becomes the cause of both of them.
So yeah, it is. In fact, that seed, the ripening of that seed is the cause of both of them, but those two effects, the effects or the results of the ripening of that seed, they occur simultaneously.
Correct.
So the consciousness is simultaneous. For Chittamatra, the consciousness that's perceiving, say, color blue, is simultaneous with the
blue.
That instant of blue. There may be a continuum of instants of blue. There may be a continuum, a bunch of seeds for that continuum of consciousness. One seed ripens for one consciousness and its object that are simultaneous. Then another seed ripens for the next instant of consciousness and its object, which is simultaneous with it. That's the Chittamatra view. And they say, reason, they quote the Buddha, that the Buddha said, when consciousness perceives, it perceives a present object. Remember? And so the Prasangika said, the Buddha said present, but what was implied by that is that there's no intervening moment between the object of a prior instant and the next instant of consciousness that realizes, that perceives it, because the consciousness arises as a causal, as a result of the cause of the object coming in contact with the object.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Okay.
The consciousness that arises is not caused by the object, but it's actually caused by the seed in the consciousness before that.
You could say that, but so even the Chittamatra says that the cause of the consciousness, which comes from the seed, is the object which is simultaneous with it. They don't say that it is the cause; it is caused by the seed.
Yeah.
They in general to have a consciousness, generally you need three conditions, right? What are the three conditions for consciousness? The object condition?
The subject, the mind.
So you have, that's called the immediate condition. The object condition, the immediate condition, which is a previous moment of consciousness, and then the dominant condition, which means the faculty. Those three have to come together through the mental factor contact. When we talk about the mental factors, remember the, five omnipresent mental factors. One of them is called contact. And that's the activating of the faculty, let's say the eye faculty, by the consciousness coming there and coming in contact with the object condition, the immediately preceding condition, which means a previous moment of consciousness. And in that consciousness, there is a mental factor that activates the subtle matter of the eye faculty to act as a support for the perception of that object. So those three come together. So also there's a presentation in Chittamatra of that. Also, they say that it is still, that kind of presentation is still correct. Chittamatra still accepts that, although everything is coming, the subject mind and the object that it perceives are both coming from one predisposition, so they are simultaneous with one another. That's what the Chittamatra says. So you have to think more, if you wanted to propose that the seed itself was the cause. Both, it is. You could say the seed is the cause of the consciousness and the object, but those two results of the seed, because the seed is the cause, they both are simultaneous. And this, that you might say that is a substantial cause of the consciousness in a certain sense. The seed is a substantial cause of the object, but the also another cause of the consciousness perceiving this is the object itself. So, yeah. The view of the Chittamatra is very subtle, and sometimes you might think, if it's going to be superseded by the Prasangika or Majjhimaka view, why study that? Oh, because there are many things about it that have connection with more subtle presentation. Like, say, for instance, one of the names of the Chittamatra is the Yogacara, right? So many of the practices of Tantra have some similarity to Chittamatra. When we talk about in Tantra, all phenomena are of the nature of the subtle mind and things like this. So I think Maitreya, in presenting that, was laying seeds in our consciousness for other reasons also. It's not just as a stepping stone to understanding the Majjhimaka view, but also for other reasons involved with practice, yoga practice, meditation, and so forth. Anyone else have a question? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Weichin has the phone, so he has the microphone, so he gets first dibs, okay.
Very good, George. During the meditation, when we turn away from looking at the object, turn back to look at the subject and away from the object, that subject, is it the sense of I that which we believe to be real?
No, not at the beginning. What you're perceiving at first, this is just a way of talking. Say, one part of the mind, if I'm holding my hands like this, like a big balloon, okay, the entity of the mind, maybe one part of the mind is as though watching the mind itself rather than watching the objects in the mind, the thoughts. Are the thoughts in the mind mind? Are they consciousness? They're not mind, otherwise those thoughts would be perceiving other thoughts and having other experiences. So they are the entity of the mind. They're the same nature of the mind, but they're different. But they themselves arise out of the clarity of the mind, sort of like there's nothing there in the mind, and then they arise due to different conditions, karma ripening, and then they disappear. Those thoughts can arise as objects of the mind. They can have a certain durability or life if we pay attention to them. Like if you think they said bad words about me. What do they know? And actually, they've got this, sort of inappropriate attention, paying attention to that thought. Gives it energy. That's like its lifeblood. That's like the oxygen that lets it live. So if you take your attention away from the thoughts and focus on something else, such as the clarity of the mind around it, not just the clarity of the mind around it, the very fact that that thought is being perceived by consciousness, that thought is the very nature of consciousness. It is not consciousness, but the nature of consciousness. So even looking at it, you're looking at it in a different way. The same way when we talked about the antidotes to anger. If you look at the person who's causing you some problem and you're inappropriately thinking about it, yeah, they're the cause of my problem. I don't need them, they're just bad. Instead, you can be looking at the person with a different thought process and thinking, this is my guru. This person is giving me the opportunity to practice patience. This person has been my mother in previous lifetimes. I wouldn't want to harm them. Even looking at them in the same way, you're diffusing and you're not fueling the anger. So something similar here. When you watch the mind, even if you don't turn away from or try to cut off the thought, even just thinking of it in a different way, this is the nature of mind. And as you're thinking this is the nature of the mind, the nature of mind is clear and knowing. So right where that object is, it's as though it can begin to dissolve back into the clarity. The different ways in meditating on the mind like that. Okay? And you had a question. I think San, isn't it?
I'm not sure if I understand it correctly. So you're saying the Chitta Mantra is saying that when we see things,
The what?
Chitta Mantra.
Got that part?
Says. This just to clarify what
understood. Say what?
That when we see things, it's because our mind.
I couldn't understand what she's saying.
The Chitta Mantra is saying when we see things. It's because of our mind.
Right? It's not external to us, but it's just a reflection of our mind.
It's not external to us, it's just a reflection of our mind.
Then, if no one is around, then does that thing still exist? Like I put a CCTV camera, there's no mind. There's just a CCTV camera.
So this famous question, you know, what's that famous thing in English? If a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there, what does it say? Does it make sound, or what is it? What's the expression? Do you know what I'm talking about? There's some Western philosophy or something. If there's no one there,
did the tree fall?
Does the tree fall or something?
Or even if there's a tree or no tree, who cares?
So this is also a dilemma in Chittamatra. So when Lama Yeshe first taught us this Chittamatra text, one of the texts that Maitreya gave to a sangha. That question comes up. Well, there's other kinds of questions also. Say, for instance, my perception of you is arising from seeds in my consciousness. When I see you, there is one seed that has arisen as the consciousness that is seeing you, and another seed which is, let's say, the object of your form, shape and color, and so forth. So that would seem to imply there are no external sentient beings to the mind. So is all of this a total illusion, all of the separate sentient beings that have their own mind streams? So I'm seeing you, you're seeing me. There's a lot of difficult points to go over. In terms of like your question about if you were to say, so what was the main thing? I can't understand your accent, so on.
You say if Chitta Mantra says that this is because of my mind.
If this cushion is the nature of your mind.
It's here because of my mind, right?
It's when we say it's here, it's perceived because of imprint in your mind that's ripening as the both subject and object, yeah?
So it's saying that if it's an ant mind won't see the cushion, right?
The what?
The ant. The small ant.
The small what?
Ant. A-N-T. If there's an ant.
They won't see the cushion.
They won't see the cushion.
Okay, well, the same question about the sentient beings. So other sentient beings... Yeah.
But if I put a CCTV camera...
Uh-huh.
TV camera.
They will see the... So
if you have a recording going on, like a videotape,
I don't need a mind to have.
Yeah. So say, for instance, if that video camera is here and all of you leave,
does it have a seat too?
Yeah.
No. That doesn't. Does that camera have mind? No, I don't think so. There are questions like this. Something. Like another sentient being perceiving me, different people perceiving me, how can they all have the same appearance? If you ask later, how did George look, and you all have the same opinion, he looked a little tired today, or he looked like he had a scratch on his face or something, you all had the same experience, how does that come about if your perception of me all arises from the predispositions on your own consciousness? So there are ways that the Chittamatra would try to explain that. Collective karma. You all share some collective karma to see me in that similar way. Some may have your own particular karma. To some of you, I might look like an enemy. To some, you might perceive me as a friend or something. That's your own individual karma. But there are these kinds of, it seems like inconsistencies from the point of view of analyzing the Chittamatra, especially about these questions, about how can there be other sentient beings that have their own continuums that will achieve these various states in the future. So that's something to research a little bit about. Okay, I've gone over a little over, was it 3, right? It was close to 3:30? Oh, 3:30, we still got a little bit of time. Okay, so someone else have a question? Yeah, follow up. One follow up like in the news conference. Right?
Is it very important to choose between we accept simultaneous arising?
Between the what?
Is it very important to choose
whether
between
we can accept simultaneous arising or what Prasangika said, mind preceding the next moment of the mind? Must we choose either one of them?
Well, yeah. If you said there's these two points of view, one is that consciousness and its objects are simultaneous. The object that a consciousness perceives is exactly simultaneous with the consciousness, or the Prasangika position that the consciousness is always one instant different than the object. Yeah, you should choose, because one is, we believe one is in accordance with the law of cause and effect, and one is not. So it's not as though, it doesn't matter which one you choose. If you were to uphold the Chittamatra position as your practice, maybe you would try to hold that position that consciousness and the objects it perceives are simultaneous. There's some people who actually practice, who think, yeah, actually, Chittamatra view fits my mind. Some people, and so they have a way of maybe they'd have to accept that particular fact. Some people, for some people, the Svatantrika Majjhimaka view, that phenomena are empty of inherent existence, but still there's something naturally there that's the basis of imputation. Otherwise, how could everyone impute a cup? Everyone agrees there's a cup here. How could you, if there's nothing existing here, how could you impute a cup? So they say that there is inherently existent cup, but is empty of true existence. That's for the Prasangika point of view. You surprised? Are you surprised? From the Prasangika point of view, not only is it empty of true existence, it's empty of inherent existence. There's nothing here which is inherently an inherently existent basis of imputation. You might think, it's maybe not truly existent, it's just imputed by mind, but still there's got to be something there. Otherwise I could impute my handbag as a cup, or I can impute my hand as an elephant or something like that. If you didn't have any, if there was not, the Svatantrika says there has to be something inherently there as the basis to give the name.
So what is the difference between true existence and inherent existence?
For Prasangika, they mean the same thing.
Okay.
But for the Svatantrika, a phenomena can be inherently existent, but definitely lacks true existence. For Chittamatra, the cup is what? Is it inherently existent?
Yes.
Is it truly existent? Both.
Both.
Yeah. So there's different views. Chittamatra is both truly existent and inherently existent. For Svatantrika, it's inherently existent but not truly existent. For Prasangika, it's neither inherently existent nor truly existent. From a Svatantrika point of view, another hypothetical synonym of inherently existent is existing from its own side. So there is something existing from its own side here for Svatantrika. We haven't talked yet. Next week we're going to talk more about Svatantrika. There's something existing here from its own side, but it doesn't truly exist. It only exists when you impute the object on that that basis that's existing from its own side. So it's, to really understand the subtlety, you know, you can use words, you know, is, oh yeah, phenomena are not truly existent. To really get a taste of that, you have to study these various views, weigh them, just as you're doing right now. Very good, you know. But this, isn't that contradictory with that? You get a finer and finer understanding of the views of those systems, and then you can see more precisely what the Prasangika view is. So I applaud that kind of thinking, you know, you know these doubts that you have, and I encourage you to go back, read other things. If you have doubts, we can address them in our next class again.
Just one more.
Yeah.
Every time we say the generic image, for example, of a cup that we have in our mind, is everything that's non-cup. That generic image is actually a non-cup. How do we know that it's true, that it's non-cup? Why is it that it's not a cup that we have?
Well, I don't know that it's true, but that this is in that particular way of explaining how conception works because we know that conception doesn't actually perceive the actual objects, right? It knows objects, you think of objects not because you're actually touching the object like perception, direct perception, seeing or hearing or tasting. In a certain sense, you have a direct perception of something. Right?
Yes.
Whereas conception, when you think, you're not directly perceiving that thing. It's some other indirect process. So it's said that, and I'm not sure if it's explained in the sutra or what place the Buddha said this, but Dharmakirti and Dignaga and Dharmakirti proposed, through their analysis of the Buddhist teachings, through logic and so forth, that the process by which we think of things is one of negating. So you're not directly perceiving the cup. What you're thinking about is you're having an image of something which is the opposite of non-cup. So non-cup is everything which is not cup, right? Is this non-cup? This, the top of this other cup, that's non-cup. My iPad is non-cup. I'm non-cup. Everything that's not cup. It's sort of like if you imagine some three-dimensional image of the whole universe. Non-cup would be everything except right here where the cup is. It'd just be a void. Everything else is non-cup, right? Yeah. If you take the opposite of that, you come back. Now the opposite of non-cup. I was an example of non-cup, but the opposite of me is no longer me. When you take the opposite of non-cup, everything else disappears, and you come back to just cup. Right? It's said that is in essence what that mental image is like. Why is that? Because that mode of explanation, it doesn't mean that that's actually what's happening, but that mode of explanation of what the generic image is accords with its qualities. Because when you perceive a generic image of something, a mental image of something, not all the qualities of that phenomena appear to you at the same time. When you perceive a cup with direct perception, the colors are simultaneous with its shape, with its impermanence. All of the qualities appear to you simultaneously. It's called a collective engager. It's engaging its object by all of its collected properties appearing to you. Conception is called a, what's it called, ladies? Did you study? Eliminative engager. It's only perceiving one quality, eliminating all the rest. So that process of talking about opposite of non-cup, that has that quality. It doesn't mean that your mind actually thinks of everything that's non-cup and then goes back to this. It's just, it says that that explains the quality of the generic image. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that that is, that in order to have a mental image of your mother's face, you have to think of every other person's face and then say, not those! And then your mother's face would appear.
Yes.
That'd be very amazing. But that way of presenting it accords with the qualities of what we actually experience when we think. Okay. Thinking, have you heard that term? Did you guys hear that term when you studied Loring? Eliminative engager, collective engager?
Yeah.
The ladies behind you, I'm just wondering. Not, okay. Don't worry, it's not going to be on the exam. That's okay. I know it's hard. Did you have a question? I thought you might have been raising your hand before. No, okay. No, he's... Oh, maybe he says, given the opportunity, he's going to try.
Okay, so Chitta Mantra, mind-only school.
Right.
It sounds to me that it put everything back related to one's own mind.
Right.
And be it the existence of certain object and how it exists simultaneously with our conscious or together with the image of that. Does it put the concept closer to even before Buddhism, the Veda, have the wisdom connected to one's own mind and as the center of the world? And it's a bit backward to me than the Four Noble Truths, even talking about compassion and sentient beings suffering. So it's a bit backward to me.
Actually, Four Noble Truths don't talk so much about suffering, interestingly. Mainly talking about compassion. It's talking about our own condition, generally. You could apply it to, you know, to generate compassion and so forth. So the origin... Where did the Chittamatra, this idea of this set of tenets, come about? There are hints of it in the Buddhist sutras. Like I say, in the Lankavatara Sutra, the Buddha said, all three realms are Chittamatra. But it's Chitta, right? Not Chinta. Chitta. Chittamatra. Only mind. And in the Lankavatara Sutra, the Buddha also mentions Chittamatra. So there's some hints of that in the sutras, but there weren't a lot of proponents early on that there was this view of mind and its objects coming from the same seed. This particular interpretation came from the teachings of Maitreya, the future Buddha, that were given to a Sangha when he ascended to Tushita heaven for something like 50 earth years, right? You know do you know the story? When he came back, what did he look? Did he look younger or older? He'd been gone for 50 years. Everyone else looked old, and he looked the same age because he'd only spent, one morning or two mornings or something in Tushita heaven. So for him, it was essentially the same. So if you want to keep your young looks, go up to Tushita heaven for some time, and then you come back, and those people that are proud now that they look younger than you will look older than you. Okay. So when he came back, he brought these texts. Most of the texts of the five texts can be interpreted from the Chittamatra point of view. Some of them very explicitly teaching the Chittamatra point of view that we're presenting here. So it didn't exist as a tenet system from the time of the Buddha, Maybe there were hints of it that when the Buddha used this expression, mind only, but he didn't elaborate all of these different things. Some other subjects that we didn't cover that the Chittamatra talks about are the Alaya Vijnana. Did we talk? Oh, we talked a little bit when we talked about the eight consciousness, the Alaya Vijnana. The Alaya Vijnana, one of the eight consciousnesses, there's the six consciousnesses, and then an afflicted consciousness, which is like ego grasping, and then the Alaya Vijnana. So the afflicted consciousness perceives the Alaya Vijnana and perceives it to be a real existent person. So anyway, there's all sorts of intricacies that you don't find in the Buddha's teachings, but when Maitreya gave this teaching as a system that a Sangha then disseminated, the aim was to help people understand the finer, more deep Majjhimaka point of view, which at first is very difficult to accept, that there's no true existence. From the Chittamatra point of view, the mind truly exists. You know, from the Prasangika point of view, the mind does not truly exist. So for some people that they can't get their mind around non-true existence or non-inherent existence, it seems like things are really, really here. So this is kind of like a midway, a stepping stone to understanding that more subtle view. It didn't exist necessarily in complete form, this philosophy, the Chittamatra view, from the beginning, from the Buddha's teachings. Maybe the Buddha had that intention. Buddha's omniscient mind knew that eventually Maitreya would write a composition that would present this view. So there's some hints in the sutras, but it wasn't laid out in the Buddha sutras. And it looks more as a didactic method, you know, a method of teaching to help people understand something that's more subtle by giving some example. There are a lot of examples like this in the Buddha's teachings. When we talk about, there's an analogy in maybe the Lotus Sutra of a merchant who's going off with his family and a captain of a ship going off with his family and a lot of merchants to a distant location where there's incredible treasure that could be obtained. Along the way, they're going, it's a long, long journey. And along the way, the crew gets restless and frustrated, and the relatives and children have no patience any longer. So the captain says, "Wow, we're approaching our destination." It's not their final destination. It's just some beautiful island where they stay for some years, you know. And then when they get their health back and their courage back, they go on to the ultimate destination. That's sometimes used as an analogy, a teaching tool that first the Buddha taught you could achieve nirvana. You know, but then because he taught about this state, because some people, if from the very beginning, someone's calling, if from the very beginning someone, if the Buddha taught there's only enlightenment, you know, that's the goal, and that journey is so intimidating to some people, working for three countless eons for the benefit of others. So the Buddha taught as a skillful means this other destination. Actually, the other destination exists. And just as in the example of the merchant, that other island exists, you know, somewhere on your way to the greater destination. But it is when the Buddha, when in some of the tenets it says, some people reach this nirvana and that's their final destination. That was not a definitive teaching. Really, the final destination is way off there, enlightenment. But he taught this as a skillful means, that this was a definitive destination, nirvana, so that people would have full energy to engage in that. So the Chittamatra, yeah, if is this the first time you've heard something about Chittamatra? So it can be seem a little counterintuitive at first, but for some people it fits their mind. And as I said before, if we were to go into more detail about it, one of the reasons that supposedly the Buddha taught Chittamatra, he used the term in his sutras, was that if we have attraction to outer things as though they really exist, they're out there, you know, that's the cause of our delusions. If not, you can't understand they don't inherently exist, but if you can understand or believe that they're not really out there, findable, out there, external to the mind, they're just arising with the mind from one seed, already that causes the mind to be less attractive, less find them less attractive. It's a cause, by understanding that, one's own attraction to them, one's own attachment to them, desire for them can be reduced. So it's a skillful means that the Buddha gave, not as the final teaching, but as a skillful means that can lead you to that final teaching. So, I think that's enough. You guys are exhausted. I applaud you and rejoice in your kindness, you know. No one, maybe one person or two left, I don't know, or maybe they were going out to the toilet, coming back. Thank you for your attention. We're gonna have one more class, I think in a week or 8 days, I'm not sure if it's next week, when we'll have a chance to talk about the Majjhimaka and especially the Prasangika system. So let's finish with a little dedication. See if you can remember that clear light nature of your mind, bring you back to a calm state. Let go of all the confusion that may have been generated right now. Like all of the, like Lama Geshe had said, when this one monk had said he couldn't meditate on the clear light of the mind, there was all this stuff going on in his mind. Lama said, that's the best time. Just let go of all those thoughts and sense the clear light nature within which they're arising. And within that clear light, recall that we've created virtuous karma this morning by our patience, our discrimination, listening, weighing. This karma, being virtuous, will definitely ripen as something pleasant in cyclic existence, either this or future lives. But like the reins of a horse, see if you can make a very strong intention to point it in a particular direction, not just to some superficial samsaric pleasure that will be experienced and then be gone, but in whatever way this ripens, may it act as a cause of my continued spiritual development. And in so doing, as that spiritual development increases, may I open my heart to others, develop empathy and love. May I develop renunciation of cyclic existence as a result of this karma, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness. Think, may this karma not be exhausted until I actually achieve the state of omniscience, when I can effortlessly and spontaneously bring about the benefit of sentient beings. Due to these merits, may I quickly become enlightened for the sake of all living beings. Thank you very much. I think before our next class here, there's one other class that's going to happen on karma. If you have any friends that don't know much about karma, or if they do know much about karma, they can come. I think those are during the weekdays, right? And then this coming attendance class will be either next Sunday. Is it next Sunday? Next Sunday. Thank you.